Right, the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Thank you all very much. So just a little bit about logistics. Senator Dembrough will be coming. Senator Cruz is here, but not for long. And my good friend, Senator Olson, is not able to be with us today, and we miss him and send him all of our best thoughts.
And Madam Chair, he will be out all week, as I understand.
That's my understanding. Okay. That is my understanding. So, but on that note, initially the understanding had been that he was going to be here on Thursday, and he had really wanted to be here for the dog and cat bill. So we had initially planned to wait and do dogs and cats on Thursday when Senator Olson was here. So I had not rushed on getting things in for fiscal. So if we get them back today, we can take care of our kitties and puppies. And if not, we will be back on Thursday. So we're going to briefly open to hear from Senator Whitsitt, who is also not here for long. And
I just saw him just a couple minutes ago. So
there he is. He's right there. Oh, I thought you meant he left. And then we're going to bounce out of that and do dogs and cats the very last. And I also want to make very clear, we are not doing a public hearing on 3494 today. We'll hear from Senator Whitsitt, Representative Barton, and then the Vets and the Humane Society about some of the work that's been done. We had the public hearing the other day. So I am opening up the work session on House Bill 3494A. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsitt, representing Senate District 28, Klamath Lake, Crook, Deschutes, and Jackson counties.
Tiny, tiny geography.
Yes. High country. So House Bill 3494A is an unnecessary and unwelcome regulation of veterinary practice. That's all it is. Declawing of cats and debarking of dogs are surgeries that are regulated by the Veterinary Practice Act. Appropriate anesthesia and pain control are required components of veterinary surgery, the daily practice. These procedures are almost always performed when the barking of dogs or the destructive nature of the use of claws by cats have become untenable for the pet owner or their neighbors. It's that simple. Declawing of cats is nearly always restricted to the front paws, unless there's aggressive scratching. I mean, if the cat is tearing up your kids with the hind claws, you might want to have that done. But for the most part, the destructive nature of cats is scratching and destroying furniture and rugs and so forth. So there are basically four options when a cat or a dog is presented to the veterinarian. You can perform the surgery as required following pre-surgical consultation, which is always done in veterinary practice. You always do your consultation with the owner. These are the options. You can support adoption to another pet owner, but if you're really honest with them, you're likely not going to adopt the pet to somebody because if you have a barking dog or a cat that destroys furniture, if you're honest with them, they're not going to take the cat or the dog. You can turn the animal loose in the countryside, which living out in the country we see all the time. I'm sure Senator Cruz sees it as well. People just drive out, open the door, kick the dog or cat out, and drive away. Many cats are equipped to survive in nature. They learn. Most dogs aren't. Many of them starve to death, get hit by cars, whatever. That's the other alternative. And the fourth alternative is to destroy the pet. Euthanize it. So I would guess, you know, I've never asked a cat or a dog if they had a preference because you don't get to do that. But I'm sure if you were to able to ask a cat or dog, would you rather have your bad habit addressed by declawing or muting your bark or dying? I think they'd probably choose the surgery, as most owners do. It is a veterinary surgical practice that does not need further regulation, period. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Are there any questions for Senator Whitsitt?
No, just one comment, though. We had a German Shepherd that we got to the point where we knew that we couldn't keep him here. But by gum, we found someone on a ranch out in Central Oregon that took it, and the dog thrived wonderfully.
Thank you for asking first, because too often they just appear running down the lane, lost, looking around, terrified. They're, where's my master?
Senator, what do you think that, and, you know, this may not be a legislative responsibility, but a societal responsibility to help people be more aware of the responsibility that they undertake when they bring an animal home. So, I mean, I've known people who have brought an animal in and then surrendered it because it defecates or it, you know, pees on the wall or it scratches or it barks. I mean, I think these are all things that animals do. Do you think that there's enough... And again, I'm not suggesting that we legislate this, but how can we help people make smarter choices about whether or not they are suited to have an animal in their home, if they're able to tolerate the inconveniences that might come with an animal being an animal?
I think that's what many pet breeders do, what veterinarians do, what humane societies do. If you go to a humane society to adopt an animal, sometimes the checkup on you is almost as complete as if you're adopting a child. I mean, they want to know where you're going to keep the animal and how are you going to feed it, how are you going to groom it, that's the sort of thing. It's always a problem. People acquire cats and dogs as pets and other pets. To be crude, sort of the same. Often, you know, like they acquire children, they don't have to have a license; they just acquire one. And so, you can make the same argument for a parent who doesn't have parenting skills. And I think, for the most part, again, people who raise animals professionally as pets, veterinarians, and humane societies, and so forth, do a good job, I think, of educating people as to what is appropriate and what is not.
And then I've been really wrestling with the issue of regulating a medical practice. And you kind of mentioned the comparison between animals and kids. We would not allow in the human medical profession a child that throws a lot of temper tantrums or is very mouthy to be devocalized. I mean, we've regulated that. We haven't allowed the... you know, the pediatrician to say, well, we can either devocalize your 3-year-old or adopt him out. I mean, what's the difference? Why is it okay to regulate that scientific medical practice and not this scientific medical practice?
Chuck Elser, most people don't turn their children loose in the countryside or have them euthanized as an alternative. And those are two of the four alternatives. I'll tell you a story. This happened years ago. I had a rancher client, a sheepman, good guy, really liked him. He came in one day with a 3-year-old border collie, and he's a sheepdog. And he said, Doc, I want you to pull all his teeth. And I looked at him like, you got to have two heads. And I said, I can't do that. And I looked in the dog's mouth. His teeth were perfect. And he kind of teared up. He said, well, then you're going to have to kill him, because he's biting my grandchildren. I pulled his teeth. Was it a good medical practice? No. Did it save the dog's life? Yes, it did. Because he was deadly serious. He wasn't going to take the dog home and let it bite the children anymore.
All right. Are there any other questions? Thank you so much for making time to come see us, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Kelsey.
Thank you.
Commanders.
Okay, I'm going to temporarily close the work session on House Bill 3494 and open up a public hearing on House Bill. Well, actually, first I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2564A. And colleagues, this is the inclusionary zoning bill. We are still working on this. As you know, we're close to our deadline. We are going to send it to rules so that that conversation can continue. Senator Dimbrough.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2564A be sent to the Rules Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dimbrough moves House Bill 2564A be moved to the Rules Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I would prefer that it be sent with no recommendation because it is a work in progress.
I'm confident, Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
I'm confident the Rules Committee will get it to a place where we can pass it.
I would kind of like to send it with a do pass recommendation just because there are so many things down there to just send that signal that we're serious about wanting that work to continue. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection?
Yeah, I will object.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Any further objection? Seeing none, it heads to rules. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2564A and opening up a public hearing on House Bill 3243A. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, 3243A expands the definition of deceased indigent person to include those for whom no one wishes to pay for or provide direction regarding funeral arrangements. It transfers the duty to maintain a list of institutions that accepts bodies for educational and research purposes from the Oregon Health and Science University to Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Describes the duties that funeral establishments must perform when taking custody of unclaimed bodies, extends from 5 days to 10 the time a funeral establishment must wait before transferring a body to education or research institutions, transfers the responsibility for a death certificate filing fee from the Oregon Health Authority to the board, and directs that at least $6 of the $20 filing fee be used to reimburse licensees for disposition of deceased indigent person. It also directs the board to adopt rules, regarding funds for indigent disposition and to consider historical data related to reimbursements. There is a A5 amendment that refines the definition of indigent person, so it's consistent with the new 10-day time period in the measure that funeral establishments have to wait to act, and it refines the duties of the funeral establishment when taking custody of an unclaimed body to include submission of the death report and exhausting alternatives for payment of disposition. It also limits the cost to administer the fund that governs indigent disposition to 5% of the amount collected. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has issued on both the underlying measure and the -A5, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. And is the subsequent coming because of the amendment?
I believe it's because of the fiscal statement, Madam Chair.
And they just didn't issue that
both
on the other side?
And the underlying bill, correct.
Okay. Thank you. All right, Wally Ordman, please. And colleagues, I got to first, well, I'd met him before, but I got to know Wally best when I attended his roast, which is always a good way to get to know a person.
Still on YouTube, by the way.
Is it?
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Ordeman. I'm a fifth-generation funeral director from Albany and a contract lobbyist for the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. The funeral directors in your community are very grateful that OFDA and numerous other stakeholders have crafted the proposed remedy to this frustrating and vague program of taking care of indigent deaths in Oregon. House Bill 3243 addresses situations where no responsible party is found or where a responsible party is found, but they absolve themselves of any responsibility. This bill does the following. It transfers responsibility of the program to the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, who has already entered into an interagency agreement with the Oregon Health Authority to manage parts of this program. This step alone eliminates two layers of administration within this program. It tightens the criteria for funeral homes to follow by requiring notification to state lands as well as the VA. It maintains the requirement that funeral homes offer the deceased to educational institutions. It extends the time frame from 5 days to 10 days to allow more time for responsible parties to be identified. It allows the funeral director to move forward with disposition when no responsible party is identified, or responsible parties have acquiesced, and then subsequently funeral homes, funeral directors can apply to the fund. It provides for the Mortuary and Cemetery Board to more accurately predict the number of claims expected and therefore provide a more consistent payout from the fund to the applicants. Currently, the fund collects a month's worth of fees from the death certificate filing fee and then divides that pool of fees by the number of claims in that particular month, thus zeroing out the fund. Payouts might range from $28, which that's anecdotal information coming from colleagues that have actually received reimbursement checks in the amount of $28, to the maximum of $650 in any particular month. The bill also more clearly defines the word indigent. There may never be a perfect definition for indigent. However, this bill provides the strongest language to date and gives tangible guidance to funeral directors who are placed in the position of caring for these people. This bill does not change the manner in which these seemingly anonymous citizens are taken care of in death. If anything, it strengthens the ability of funeral directors, medical examiners, and the state of Oregon to care for these folks. The funeral directors see this bill as a way to reduce vagueness in the way the indigent fund is administered, a way to receive more predictable reimbursements, a way to preserve the dignity of these seemingly anonymous Oregonians, and a way to prevent presumably responsible parties from just defaulting to the fund, and a way to administer the fund more efficiently. In short, this bill has been a long time in the making. It's a positive step toward defining the use of the fund, and it's been a collaborative effort of many entities and comes before the legislature after countless industry meetings, including the Mortuary and Cemetery Board summer strategic planning meeting in 2014, in which there were industry members present from all death care disciplines. The Oregon Funeral Directors Association strongly encourages the committee to move this to the Senate floor. We appreciate your time. Your constituent funeral homes, we feel, deserve this, and so do the indigent citizens of your communities. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Mattis Anderson.
Thank you. I do like the Dash A5s. Are you aware of what the Dash A5s are or what's in them, the amendment?
Yes, Senator.
Okay, yeah. And so I liked how the changes were for the definition. What I do have a question about is auditing. How will you audit the funeral homes or the entities of the funds and that they're being used appropriately?
Chair Gelser, Senator Mattis Anderson, this will be much more auditable, we believe, if that's a word. With the program transferring to the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, their plan, the way we understand it, is to use, they know basically how many deaths there are going to be in Oregon. They also know then how much the fund will have. So the disbursements will certainly be more predictable. In the audit of that, because the Mortuary and Cemetery Board is already tied in with their licensees with this, they will be much more able to track who is using the fund, who is maybe overusing the fund, and because they'll have that data right in front of them, there won't be the disconnect between the Oregon Health Authority and the Mortuary and Cemetery Board.
Well, I think it would be
follow up.
I think it will be nice, say, after the program gets running, that we would have a report regarding the use of the indigent fund from various entities. How many deaths there were that were appropriately compensated?
Chair Gelser, Senator Mattis Anderson, the industry would like that as well, so that we can, we that are representing the industry, can have a better track of whether the fund is being used appropriately as well.
So just one follow-up. So do you think that the industry will track these on their own or report them to their board, or how will the data be tracked then?
Chair Gelser, Senator Mattis Anderson, the industry, the burden for that tracking will fall to the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. We will certainly be looking for that information as an industry, but the data will funnel through the Mortuary and Cemetery Board.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, it appears that we could really get a higher level of accountability that way with it going through that board. It's a public board, right? It has to track its collections and expenditures.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yes, you do have further questions? No further questions. All right.
Thank you so much.
And stick around. Don't go away. We may have more questions for you after the next panel, all right?
Fair enough.
All right. Next, we have Rachel Fox and Ty Cochrane. And hopefully I said that the right way. Welcome.
Who's glasses? Thank you, Chair Gelser and committee members. I'm Rachel Fox, the president of the Cemetery Association of Oregon, and with me is Ty Cochran, who represents the legislative interests of our association. I have been in the funeral and cemetery industry since 2008, and from 2000 to 2013, I served as a public employee for Metro Regional Government. I now work for the largest corporation in North America who provides funeral, crematory, and cemetery services. During my time at Metro, I served as the manager of Oregon's largest public agency provider of municipal interments. From my public service, I'm keenly aware of the legislative process and what makes a good bill and what makes what bills need to have further vetted and researched. I and the Cemetery Association believe that this bill needs to be further refined. When House Bill 3243 first came out, the Board of the Cemetery Association of Oregon was 100% behind the Oregon Funeral Director Indigent Bill. We were not involved when the OFDA drafted the bill, so there's been some catch-up. After the House hearings, we did some research and had discussions with the Association Board and others in the industry. Through this diligence, did we see that there are some concerns with the bill. And the Cemetery Association feels it's important to point out our concerns to the committee and be on record for pointing out facts to the legislature. My written testimony was submitted to you, where you'll find that we're simply supplying information in our opinion and pointing out some facts that were not addressed in any of the impact statements or at the hearings. The Cemetery Association does not feel it would be right to sit back and say nothing when the Cemetery Association Board and others in the industry have some strong concerns about this bill. So in the end, we all have to remember that we're talking about the final disposition of a person without a loved one. We're talking about social classification and transferring the responsibility of the fund to a regulatory and licensing agency who may not be equipped to determine how to classify a segment of our population. However, the fund right now resides with the State Office of Public Health, which also houses vital statistics. That agency, on a regular basis, classifies segments of our population. So that's what the bill, among other things, proposes. Mr. Cochran will now expand on some of our concerns.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Ty Cochran. I'm with the Cemetery Association Oregon, and I've been in the cemetery and funeral industry, mainly the cemetery industry, for 32 years. I actually manage one of the larger cemeteries here in Salem. Some of the concerns I want to point out to you are, one of them is on page 1, line 13. It adds an actual one more step and segment in who can qualify as an indigent. And right now, since there is no real definition of indigent in the state of Oregon for our industry, this opens up, I guess, a can of worms, I should say. But we have enough nurses, hospice workers, healthcare workers now who are with people when they experience a death, and they turn to them and say, what do we do? We don't have any money. And that, at this point, can classify these people who simply refuse to pay for a funeral for the funeral directors in the funeral homes to actually put in for the indigent fund. I have a feeling right now some of that's happening as we speak, but one of our fears is that if this opens up, there's going to be many more indigents. There's about 400 now that claim this fund. We have a feeling it would probably double in the next few years.
And can I just ask a clarifying question? Have you seen the -5 amendments?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Another thing we wanted to point out is on page 1, line 22, there's a list of institutions. We called every one of these institutions, and not one of them accept indigents. Page 5, line 1 and 3,
Excuse me. Which version are you using? Are you looking at the A? 30.
I don't think that is that part was amended. It's my understanding.
Sorry, we have to switch. Skip now that we have everything on the screens instead of having paper next
That's
to us.
Fine.
We're all
yeah.
shifting between our different screens here, and we want to make sure that we're looking at the same version that you are.
Yep.
So, for instance, my page 5, 1 through 3 on the bill okay. that we are looking at does not have what you're talking
okay.
about.
Okay, this may have been some of what I used for the House hearing, but the there is something in the bill that lists about. The list of institutions that accept indigent bodies. I'm not sure what page that is on.
So there is a list, but that list is existing statute.
Exactly.
There is no new language that is
right, and
added.
That's a problem. That's a problem that should be addressed.
Okay, so you're not concerned about a problem that's being created by this bill. They're just, you might like to come back and
right,
work on these
absolutely.
Issues in the future.
Right.
Which we can do that. We can move this bill, and if there are other issues in this section of statute that we need to address, we can certainly take that up in our work plan to come back and work on those moving forward.
One other thing I wanted to point out, Senator Gelser, is that if we do revisit this in the future, there's about 33,000 deaths a year in Oregon. And only those people, those family members, are the ones that's paying for this indigent fund. We, of course, would like to see that to where it be based in some type of general fund and some type of taxing fund.
And it currently comes from that fee on the death certificate, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, so the segment of our population that pays for the fund are people that just lost a loved one. And we would like to explore another means to do that so we don't burden people that just experienced a death to pay for somebody else's death, whether or not that's the right thing to do to fund it. And that's a question that's been out there for quite some time. And that's another issue that we're bringing to light about just basically the statute and the bill.
Well, I think that's yeah. certainly a conversation that we can have moving forward outside the confines of this particular bill.
One other thing I'd like to point out, Senator Gelser, and I may be off on the page here, but there's the word relative used in this bill in regards to returning human remains to people. That definitely needs to be addressed because this would allow institutions or someone to give back remains of a deceased that may not be the next of kin. That has been addressed to me by independent funeral homes that have seen this bill.
And where is that? Where is that at?
Well, I had it on page 5, line 14, but I may not have been looking at the most recent.
So the correct terminology is next of kin, not relative.
And we might bring Wally back, who knows the bill in and out. I'm just not seeing that reference in here at all.
It said on the -2 amendments. It was on page 5, lines 14 and 15.
So you're looking at the amendment, not the. That's our problem. We're looking at the bill.
And we're looking at the A engrossed, correct?
I was looking at the A engrossed.
And then the -A5s, of course.
Are what we're considering. But I think he's working off the -2 amendments. So let's see. So
yes, I'm the dated 4/9/15.
Right.
-2.
So okay. The A engrossed is dated April 23rd. That's the version that it came out of the House. Yeah. So that's any further amendments are working off of the version that passed out of the House.
Well, I'm looking for in the engrossed version, it's in section 4, which is on page 3. And then I'm gonna go back and look at the -5.
Thank you.
5 amendment. Where did you go?
It's the new language. It says an institution that uses a body for ongoing research pursuant ORS 9717 shall bury respectively or cremate the remains upon completion of use. The institution cremates the remains. The institution shall deliver the ashes to a relative of the deceased person if a relative is known to the institution. If no relative is known to the institution shall hold the ashes for 3 years, et cetera. That language is a little concerning to not only us, but it should be concerning to funeral directors. Okay. It should say next of kin.
Okay, thank you.
All right. There further concerns?
Well, only that, you know, we believe that the fund is already with the Office of Public Health, and whether or not it's ever been looked at to streamline what's going on with the fund within the Office of Public Health instead of moving it to another agency. And from what I could see through the impact statements and reading all of the material, it's not clear to me that that was ever researched. And I know from being a public servant for many years, it's not an easy thing to move a program around, and that it's time consuming and costly. And so the Cemetery Association is concerned about that to the citizens of Oregon, because it'll become a cost to the citizens of Oregon. What happens to the positions and oversight in the Office of Public Health? What's going to backfill that work? So those are some of the other concerns that we have.
When you say backfill the work, are you concerned about the employees that are there that they wouldn't have this work to do?
If they're not doing this, then what will they be doing is one concern. But also, why hasn't the state looked at just streamlining the current process? And that's another concern that the associations had.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you. Thank you very much. And Wally, could you come back up for a second?
Is there someone from the health authority here that wants to
Is there anybody
speak?
Here from the health authority? Not the health authority. But where?
The cemetery board.
I think this question was about the health authority. Mm-hmm. All right.
To answer some of their questions.
Yeah, around the health authority. Great, Wally. So, and when you answer, if you could state your name for the record again one more time.
Sure.
The issue of next of kin, can you talk about that issue, the relative next of kin?
Chair Gelser, yes, I can. Wally Ordeman, Oregon Funeral Directors Association. I believe what the reference was to was for if the body had been donated to an institution, an educational institution, then the cremation that follows is what the ashes can be given to next of kin. In the state of Oregon recognizes the donation itself to these institutions as final disposition. And so the next of kin does not necessarily come into play. The donation to the institution itself is considered disposition, final disposition, just like burial or cremation would. I also, Michelle Gaines, the executive director of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, is here as well and could possibly clarify some points as
well.
All right,
could you come up too? Is that, I know you're not on the list. Can I put you on the spot?
Sure.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Michelle Sigmund Gaines. I'm with the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, executive director. Happy to address any of the questions.
Well, can you talk a little bit about that issue of streamlining and if you anticipate this will cause a problem in state government?
The short answer is, in my opinion, it will not. I have been working with the board for about 6 years. In that time, I've been working closely with the different portions of the Oregon Health Authority, which at the time were the two separate agencies of DHS and OHA, and this was actually in what was originally the DHS. At that time, before a lot of the restructuring, there were staff and personnel where the program had their own financial analysts. They had a program analyst, and they had a manager that had time over that in the Division of Public Health. At that time, there were two divisions in DHS at the time. The information comes in from the Center for Vital Statistics, which is where the records of death are filed. That information was transmitted over to the other division in public health. Then when OHA, or the Oregon Health Authority, was formed, and they centralized a lot of services, all of the financial analysts from that program and all the others were moved down to Salem into a central division. And the indigent disposition program no longer had the same staffing or capacity at that time. So then you had three different divisions in the Oregon Health Authority that were processing the different claims. The Mortuary and Cemetery Board has always had the fourth major piece of it, which is the back end or the enforcement or the compliance for payment when anyone is in arrears or if there's any issues with a particular form that has been completed where there's some question about whether it was a qualified claim. That is already referred over to our organization. And so that's the role we've been playing. There have been a couple of major issues in the last 5 years as sort of those staffing changes has occurred. And frankly, I can say that the Oregon Health Authority, all of those parties they're officially neutral on this bill. They are supportive of moving the function to the mortuary board. In fact, we've entered into an interagency agreement with them for us to take over that staffing because we have the capacity and the staffing to be able to support it. They do not actually have any specific staff that are allocated to that. All they have from a funding standpoint is the 5% of the indigent portion in order to fund their administrative costs. Their administrative costs, particularly because there's three divisions over there involved in it, exceed the revenue that could come in to cover it.
Great. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions for this panel? No, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Having worked in public health for most of my career, nursing career, I'm very aware of the problems, especially now that we've divided out everything. And to me, it looks like it would be much more streamlined by putting it into your board due to the various functions that, DHS has an unsustainable budget at this point in time, I think was what they said on the floor. And so I look at this as streamlining and more efficient, and I'm hoping, that's why I would love to have a report after it's been implemented on how the program's working.
Right. And I think what I'd like to do is invite you back after it's implemented so that we can talk a little bit about this. It sounds like there's other issues in this section of law that we can have some further discussion about. For today, I think this bill for the portions of the statute that it's working on is ready to go. I think it's a good bill. I know there's been a lot of work that's gone into it. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3243 and open up a work session on House Bill 3243A.
Madam Chair, I move the -A5 amendments into House Bill 3243A, amendments dated 5/26/2015.
Senator Montes Anderson moves the -5 amendments into House Bill 3243A. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Montes Anderson.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3243A with the as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Montes Anderson moves House Bill 3243A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? No. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the bill heads to Ways and Means and doesn't need a carrier.
That's correct. And senators are excused.
And please mark Senator Olson and Cruz as excused. Thank you. All right. Next, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3243A and opening up a work session on House Bill 3223A. 3320. Opening up a work session on 3323A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3323A was previously heard on May 19th. This is a measure that allows Type B area agencies and service areas with populations of 650,000 or more to bring civil actions for physical or financial abuse of vulnerable persons with an emergency clause. There's no revenue and a minimal fiscal. It has a dash A2 amendment, but it's my understanding there is further amendment to be had. So I won't summarize that unless you...
Great. Chris Fick and Patrick Henry, please. Thank you. Welcome back.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, other members of the committee. For the record, Chris Fick with Multnomah County. I want to start off by apologizing to the committee for our failure to follow up in person several weeks ago on some questions that were raised in the first hearing, and thank the chair and other members of the committee for allowing us to come back again, answer those questions, and talk about some amendments that came about as a result of those conversations and some questions that were raised. There was a question that was raised during the first public hearing about whether the underlying bill would allow our county attorney to pursue civil damages against folks that abuse elders as well as individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We do think we have that underlying authority, but we want to make it explicit in some amendments that aren't yet ready to move, that it does cover CDPs and brokerages and explicitly references ORS 430-745. Another amendment that we're working on, well, same amendment, but an additional tweak would be an explicit reporting requirement that we come back to the legislature and report on the number of cases, the type of cases, and the outcomes of cases that we pursue. And lastly, we've added a sunset provision to sunset the bill for counties of over 650,000 July 1st, 2018, to allow the legislature to take into account what we've reported and the successes we've had. It's also our hope, as we said at the first hearing, that other counties and area agencies on aging will be interested in this new tool to pursue those who abuse elders and folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Lastly, there was a question raised about the number of cases that we're estimating we would have in any given year. We think that would be in the 6 to 10 range, but could vary depending on resources allocated and the type of cases that we see. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Henry and be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Patrick Henry. I'm with the Multnomah County Attorney's Office. I represent the Multnomah County Department of County Human Services that includes the Aging Services Program, the Developmental Disabilities Program, and the Mental Health Program. Chair Gelser, the amendment that Mr. Fick referred to would make explicit the authority of our office to take cases and referrals from various programs within the County Human Services Department, including the Developmental Disabilities Program, as well as the Mental Health Program. We regularly have cases that we staff as a system. As a matter of fact, this morning I attended a meeting. It was called a multi-system support team that looked at cases involving developmentally disabled people and in the community who are struggling and who are in need of additional supports. So we regularly hear about cases involving people with mental illness and people with developmental disabilities, as well as cases involving people who are over 65 years of age, and welcome the opportunity to take referrals for all populations in relation to this new authority. And I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate all the work that's gone into the new amendments. Senator Mona Sanderson.
Yes, and I'm looking at the amendments, and you say you haven't dropped them because one that's proposed June 2nd were the A2s you're referring to.
Chair Gelser, Senator Mona Sanderson. Those amendments don't encompass everything we wanted and aren't as specific as we were seeking.
Okay. And Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, they were posted. We were on the floor. I saw them, and in an abundance of rush for paperwork, I sent them on before I read them or before Mr. Fick had a chance to check them out.
Great. Okay.
Any other questions, comments? Seeing none, so we will. You'll let. Do you need another note, or are you?
Chair Gelser, I don't believe so.
Okay, great. So we will carry over this work session to Thursday. So we're going to carry over the work session on House Bill 3323. Thank you very much. And DHS, are you guys okay? Okay.
They look okay.
They look great. Just, it's an exciting hearing. You know, everybody wants to come.
Any questions for DHS?
Well. We always have questions for Dean. Did you have anything you wanted to put on the record? No. Okay. And is everybody okay? Okay. All right. With that, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3323A, carrying over House Bill 3323A to Thursday, and going back to reopen the work session on House Bill 3494A. So first, a status update. You already did the introduction, so you don't have to do it again.
I didn't summarize the motion.
Oh, you didn't? I think we all know what it's about.
There are a number of amendments to
do. I'm going to let the folks that have been working on the amendments talk about that, if that's okay. And any word from fiscal?
I'm refreshing the screen
okay.
as we speak.
Okay, excellent. So I would like to invite up Representative Barton, Sharon Harmon, and Laura Smith, please. I'm going to invite up Chuck. Thank you. So just as a refresh for everybody that's here, this is the bill that relates to devocalization of dogs and decline of cats. There are a lot of amendments that have been drafted over the last several days. I think in the last episode of House Bill 3494 hearing, we had a lot of testimony and recognized that more work needed to be done on the underlying bill and that the amendment had some issues like dew claws. And I met a puppy with dew claws this week, and it was really a cute dog. So all of you have been working on a variety of amendments. I understand that you maybe aren't in complete agreement, but pretty close, and that you have a pair of amendments that have a slight difference between the two of them. So maybe, Representative Barton, do you want to kick it off, and then we can see what we've got.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. For the record, I'm Brent Barton. I represent Oregon House District 40. And again, I'd like to thank this committee for its patience throughout this process. The hearing last time was a very engaged hearing for this committee. You guys invested a fairly engaged hour and 40 minutes, by my count, into this bill. I really appreciate that. That's as good as the Oregon legislative process gets, and I think this legislation is really better for it. I'd like to thank the partners, both those who are sitting up at this with me, and as well as some in the audience that we've been working with. We've had a series of very productive conversations, and really just this afternoon, it seems that the discourse has crystallized into two policy choices for this committee. And I will highlight them for you, and perhaps you can engage some of the others. And they are, and I don't know if they're on OLIS yet, the -A8 and the -A9 amendments. Those are, I think, the two that present a pretty stark policy choice for you. And I recognize, I truly recognize that it's not just a choice. We don't have a magic wand in this process. That there are things to consider, such as what we can get through the Senate floor and across the House floor. But again, I will look to this committee and to you, Chair Gelser, for some direction. Let me start with the simpler of the two. That is the -A9. Now, the -A8, which I'll talk about later, goes further than the -A9. And at the risk of oversimplifying, and not to put words in their mouth, but I think that OVMA, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, prefers the -A9, whereas perhaps the Oregon Humane Society, myself, and others might prefer the -A8. But again, these are preferences, and this is a choice that we could use direction from this committee on. Let me tell you what the things that both of these amendments do, because they have some in common. Number one, a technical change. Chair Gelser caught a technical error. That is, on page 1, line 4 of the bill, it still references the landlord-tenant chapter. I don't know if you recall that, Chair Gelser, but both of these versions strike that. As LC decided that they're going to number the chapter later in the revision process. Number two, both of these measures expand the language regarding the devocalization of dogs, which has not been controversial, essentially restricting it to only situations in which it is medically necessary for the health of the animal. So that right there is significant consensus that was forged from the process. That's progress that's being made for dogs in Oregon. Neither amendment has anything to do with the pulling a dog's teeth for non-medical purposes. That's something perhaps I will address in later legislation. Now, in they both then the dash A9 and the dash A8 goes on and expands the decline provision. It expands it from cat to all animals and creates a new exemption for the due clause of a dog. Again, I don't think there's anything controversial there. And the dash A9, it talks about, for example, if it's medically necessary to treat illness, disease, injury, or correct a congenital abnormality, that would be a reason to exemption to allow the decline of cats. And then there is one exemption under C, which is necessary to modify the destructive use of the animal's claws where attempts to prevent the animal from destructively using the claws have failed or present a serious health risk. Now, if it falls under that exemption, which is broad and I think will prove controversial, it requires the veterinarian performing the procedure to explain the surgical procedure, potential complications, require a 48-hour waiting period. My understanding is that came at the suggestion of OVMA. Also, in interesting development, we'll start to report and collect the data so that we can start to see, actually get good data, how many decline procedures performed in Oregon and why, and provide some written documentation. That is what the dash A9 does. The dash A8 does that as well, but in 2018, it phases in essentially a complete ban of decline, i.e., it would only be necessary for the health of the animal, oversimplifying somewhat. But did that make sense, the difference between the dash A8 and A9? The same thing, A8 includes phases in a more sweeping restriction.
And it did. One question that I had, when we talked up in my office earlier today, I hadn't had a chance to read these today, but I really appreciated getting the memo from OVMA last week and talked with Laura. And I had understood that in both the A8s and A9s, that one of the changes that was going to be made was around the destructive use of claws. We were going to limit that so that that was destructive use of claws on another person that was causing injury rather than destructive use of claws on carpet or antique furniture, or that even in the eights we weren't going to do behavioral for property but only if the owner is being seriously injured by the cat or the kids.
And I'm happy to defer to Laura or committee administrator. In my reading, and again, I've just reviewed this starting this afternoon, so I don't have too much more head time than you, Chair Gelser.
I think it could be
destructive use of animals' claws where, subsection 1, attempts to prevent the animal from destructively using its claws have failed, or, subsection 2, animals' destructive use of its claws presents a serious risk to the animal or its owner. So I'm not sure if that subsection 1 seems to go as far as you thought it might.
And I don't think it does. I think that could be addressed. And I had talked with a local veterinarian yesterday. Mm-hmm. Actually, the veterinarian that had me rehome my cat that was destructively hurting me. That there's a difference between a serious health risk to the owner where there's, and I know that's controversial and not everybody agrees with that, but there's a difference between that illness and then, just kind of the constantly scratching of someone. But if in line 22 on both 8 and the 9, which are identical to that point, was attempts to prevent the animal from destructively using its claws to injure a person have failed, would kind of narrow that to that that physical interaction and remove the property element.
Yeah, Chair Gelser, my initial reading, and again, I'm happy to defer to others or legislative counsel, is that dash A9 does not seem to go quite that far. Now, the dash A8 does perhaps render that moot in 2 years, in that in 2 years it introduces a more sweeping change, a restriction, shall I say. But again, I believe right. OVMA, and let me say again, they really have been excellent partners to work with. They've had, I doubt that they've enjoyed this process any more than we have, but they really have been good sports about it all, and I appreciate their cooperation.
And did I see your hand up, Senator Munson?
No.
All right. Great. Thank you. Welcome. Which of you would like to first? Eights or nines first?
Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Chuck Meyer, current president of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I would like to thank the Humane Society and Representative Barton for continuing discourse on this difficult, challenging, and emotional subject. The amendments are very similar, except for the sunsetting rule of the declaw. If I may, I would like to represent our position a little bit, probably more from a personal experience standpoint than an overall organization, but I do believe that it represents the viewpoint of the veterinarians in the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. It's not uncommon for a family to bring a pet to us with a medical concern, and oftentimes the parents and the children are present at the same time. It's also not uncommon to, on my part, to recommend medical treatment for this animal, and due to financial concerns, the parents are unable to treat the animal. When there's children involved and they have a tight emotional bond to this animal, it's also not uncommon on my part to discount my fees significantly. I consider it part of my social conscience, my responsibility to maintain that relationship between the animal and the child, which oftentimes is a strong emotional and psychological bond supporting the health of that child. My concern and the OVMA's concern with an absolute ban on declawing for destructive behavior is that presented with this situation where a parent may be inclined to dispose of the animal or eliminate the animal from the household, that it would be destructive to the child's emotional and psychological welfare. And we as veterinarians, having tried multiple other procedures, medications, behavioral modification, physical modification of the claws, end up in a position being caught between the child and the parent. That's not a comfortable position to be in. Recognizing that this child has an extremely tight bond with this animal, and this parent is bound and determined to have the animal out of the household. Without the ability to ultimately, having tried other things, to possibly perform an oncectomy on this cat and keep it in the household, it's our position, it's my position particularly, that this could possibly be severely damaging to the child. It's not uncommon for children in slightly abusive and or dysfunctional families to have an extremely tight bond with that animal. And that is their connection to health. I'm sorry. It actually concerns me that that may result in the separation of that animal from that child, affecting the health of that child. That's all I have to say regarding the difference.
And I have to ask a question. We've had some unusual testimony on this issue from a couple of veterinarians now, and one of the initial arguments was that the kind of standards of veterinary practice would prevent, you know, kind of the arbitrary amputations or other things that were damaging to animals. What do the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association standards of practice say about declawing every cat in a house or non-medical removal of all of the teeth in a dog's
mouth? The best of my knowledge, and the examining board would have to address this more expertly than I can, Chair Gelsler, but to the best of my knowledge, there are not delineations, there are not designations as to what we can and can't do in the interest of the health of the family regarding treatment on the pet. Does that answer your question?
It does. I guess what I'm struggling with is I sit on the Judiciary Committee, as does Representative Barton in the other chamber, and it's my first session on the Judiciary Committee, and we've had a number of animal abuse bills. And I guess I've struggled with this as I've been reading about this issue, and over the course of the last hour, all of the teeth being pulled from the dog is sticking with me. If that is a common practice, why do we have animal abuse laws if I can take my animal to the veterinarian and have parts of their body taken off or changed if they're inconvenient to me? I don't know. Why do we have all of this animal abuse legislation if we can take our animal to the vet and then it's not abuse anymore. We can take any part of the animal we want. And I don't mean that as, and I hear you with the deep compassion in your voice, and animals are such an important part of a family, and losing an animal is a very difficult thing. And I want to put on the record, I love my veterinarian. So, so please don't misunderstand the question. I just have been surprised by what I've learned in this process, and I've been stunned by the veterinarian, by the testimony from practicing veterinarians in this room.
Chair Gelsert, obviously, I can't speak for all veterinarians. I do think I speak for the majority of the OVMA membership, having been in the membership for some time. I will give you an example, and not speaking for all veterinarians, I did have a client come to me, someone that I knew personally, that wanted all the teeth removed from her animal because of a similar type situation. I laughed so hard that she was so embarrassed that was the last discussion we had about it. That's not something that I would consider personally in my methodologies of practice. I can't speak for all the membership, but I can't imagine, and with my understanding and experience of the profession, that that would be anything anywhere near a common practice. I've never heard of it till today. I can't speak for all. Right. I don't stand in judgment of all. Veterinarians as a whole truly cherish the animals that we treat on a daily basis. We do also truly cherish the relationship that families have with their pets. I can assure you that it is in our ultimate driving force and utmost priorities to be as humane as we can to the animal, give them the best home that we can, and preserve the relationship with the family.
Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Ms. Herman.
Chair Gelsert, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Harmon. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society. We are, for the record, unaffiliated with the Humane Society of the United States or any other group, including with similar names like Humane Oregon. I just want to say thank you to the committee. This has been an eye-opening process for all of us, listening to the diversity of opinions and the strength of the conviction about whether this is okay or an absolutely horrific process to go through. I do want to say thank you to the OVMA, because we worked very hard over the last few days to come to what I think is a remarkable movement on their part, closer to where we believe society feels about declawing and debarking. That being said, I'm yet again at another hearing shocked at what I'm hearing, that a veterinarian would offer to remove a dog's teeth to address a behavior problem. I'm shocked that to help a child, an emotionally damaged child, a child who's been abused, feel good about the pet being at home, that to address a normal behavior, we have to mutilate the animal. I can't think of a worse lesson to teach a child. If you do something normal but just bad for the day, we're going to amputate your fingers? I'm sorry. I am so shocked by what I've heard today. I thought I'd heard it all. Because really, when we talk about scratching, it's a normal behavior. If he scratches on the scratching posts, that's fine. If he scratches on the furniture, it's destructive. And does that merit amputating the ends of their paws? I don't think so. You know, when we have a behavior helpline. You know, anyone can call, and it's free of charge. Anybody can call. 75% of the calls about cats have to do with litter box issues, inappropriate elimination. They're fearful. They don't get along with the other pets. Number five is destructive behaviors, and some of that includes chewing on electrical cords or whatever else. 75% of the calls are those top four. We can help people with behavior problems. Veterinarians are not taught about cat behavior in vet school. I know. We have a partnership with Oregon State University College of Vet Med. All fourth-year students come through our program. The behavior training is taught at our shelter. Otherwise, they wouldn't get it. I'm just deeply shocked that we would consider that to help a child keep a pet, an abused child, that we would need to we would need to mutilate the cat. I'm usually, sorry, much more professional, but this has pushed me over the edge. I heard about defanging. Now hearing about that it's for the children we need to mutilate the cat, it's just wrong. The difference between the Dash 8 and the Dash 9 amendments, it really is, one, bans it in 2 years. It gives the veterinary profession time to come around, have the conversations with their clients, talk with their membership, and come to the position that we as a society are taking a position. This is not about an animal health issue. This is an animal welfare issue, and whether we think it's fair or right or moral to do a surgical solution to a normal behavior. There are exemptions for medical reasons for the animal, and I think it's time. With OVMA and the Oregon Humane Society, we were fine up until that, you know, between the Dash 8 and the Dash 9 about a ban. And I hate to put you in the position of choosing one or the other, but sorry, that's where you are. You get to be the Supreme Court today.
And for the, I guess for the Dash 9, this goes back to the doctor, would you be comfortable as the committee is looking at these, and I guess it would be in both since they mirror each other, having that language that points that destructive use of clause, that it's not furniture and property, but destructive use of clause on another person?
Limiting the destructive behavior language. Sorry, Chair Gelser.
Yeah. Limiting the destructive behavior
to
people.
Injury to people,
versus materials. To property. Yes.
I believe I would need to go back and discuss it with the executive board. I don't believe that I'm in a position to answer for the entire executive board.
Okay. Thank you. Would you be, and Ms. Harmon, do you have a thought on that?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, you know, today as I sit before you, I'd like to ban it today. But I think you know my position by now. Thank you for asking.
Thank you. And I asked that question, and I think it's something that Mr. Representative Brent, who are you? Barton. I know a lot of people have worked very hard in this room. I think I've certainly seen a very significant awareness effort in the Twitterverse out there as well. I know this is deeply important to a lot of people, and I would like to see us make as much progress as we possibly can. And then going back to Representative Barton, as far as we possibly can requires 16, 31, and 1, and I think we've got a little work to do between now and Thursday to figure out where that tipping point is. So if you'd be willing to check in with your association about that question about property, that would be most helpful. Other questions for this panel? And we do have someone that I didn't realize it had been posted for a public hearing. We've heard from many folks, but there's someone that flew here 1,000 miles, so I would like to allow that person to
I have a question for this panel.
Senator Jimbrough.
Thanks. Both versions have a reporting requirement, which I think is a really good idea to let us have a sense of what the practice is. And the reporting is to the OVMA. And I'm wondering why it's to the association as opposed to the board, where, you know, that might be a more logical place for it to go, it seems to me. Was that for fiscal reasons, or was there a reason for that?
Chair Gelser and Senator Dembrough, I note, and I'm looking at the Dash 9, there is reporting to the OVMA. However, it does state, I'm looking at page 2, line 11, the association shall report data collected from these reports to the interim legislative committees on human services by December 31st, 2016. So they are, in fact, reporting back. Now, in the Dash A8s, and I'm sorry to make a bad pun, but I think that reporting requirement sort of loses its teeth in that, sorry, bad joke, in that... I'm sorry. Yeah. That was very bad.
Too soon.
Too soon. In that a more sweeping ban would, by default, take effect in 2018.
correct, but still, I think it would be useful to know what the practice is over the next 2 years.
It would be useful.
You know, because bills can be changed in the future, obviously. I think that if we are going to amend this bill and come up with a dash 10 or whatever it becomes.
There is a dash 10. It would be at least
all right, 11.
Yeah, as long as it's under 50, I think we're okay. But a further amendment that maybe we should consider having the regulatory board be the recipient of these reports. I think that would, I don't know, just makes sense in keeping with their function. I don't know what you think of that, Doctor, if speaking for the OVMA. Do you have a preference one way or the other?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dimbrough, I don't believe we probably have a preference. I don't know what the fiscal impact to the examining board would be, and I don't know what their position would be on collecting that data.
Yeah, that would be a concern.
Senator Dimbrough, the executive director of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board is in the room. You might ask them if they put that position on that fiscal impact or practice.
All right.
For our preference, to be the examining board, but I'm not sure about its voluntary reporting of data. I'm not sure what we get.
Representative Barton.
Yeah, Chair Gelser, I want to apologize perhaps for my inappropriate remark about.
Oh, I already forgot about it.
I don't know what you guys can see faces, but I can feel perhaps the temperature rising a bit in the room. I can feel tensions mounting, and we have made progress. And these people, even though there's tensions are high right now, have negotiated in good faith. Indeed, I wish all parties in the legislative process always did that on all bills. But we might have to take the afternoon off, but perhaps there's more work that can be done starting tomorrow.
All right.
And just as a comment, I can only speak for the nursing, since I'm a nurse. It's usually the associations that do the data collection and standards of care issues, et cetera, and the board's limited to the complaint process and sanctioning people. So I don't know if the vet board is like that or not, but just an observation.
Thank you.
So could we hear from the board chair?
Yes, yeah. That would be great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Board chair, would you please come up? I would invite you by name, but I don't know your name. I'm sorry. And then on deck, we'll have Dr. Conrad. There's two of you. Welcome.
Thank you.
We come as a team.
Teams are good.
Good afternoon, Chair Gessler and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Bob Lester, a licensed Oregon veterinarian, graduate of Oregon State University's College of Veterinary Medicine, and currently
Beavs.
Go Beavs. Currently the chair of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board.
Senator Gelser and members of the committee, I'm Laurie Mockinen, director of the Oregon Veterinary Board.
Thank you. And I think Senator Dimbrough was hoping you could address that issue of appropriate landing spot for data collection.
Senator Gelser and members of the committee, we have the capacity to collect and collate and analyze the information technologically. It would be probably a matter of a few hours of programming time. We have the authority to collect that type of information. By statute, we already collect a number of other types of information that are not specifically related to the actual performance of veterinary medicine. So we could do it.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. That was easy. All right. And then, as I'd mentioned, we weren't doing a public hearing, but Dr. Conrad has flown here from far away. And we want people to like Oregon when they come, so they will come back and vacation here often. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. And I do like Oregon a lot more today than I did this morning, because I think that there's some real movement in what could happen with this bill. My name is Jennifer Conrad. I'm a veterinarian, and I'm the founder and director of the Paw Project. We are the world's largest organization dedicated solely to ending declawing. As a veterinarian, I felt it was my duty to start to bring to light what declawing really is. It's extremely painful for cats. It's often done as for kittens, just because a preemptive for them scratching. And it has to be something that people recognize as to what that really is, because most people love their cats, and when they find out what declawing really is, that it's an amputation of the animal's toe bones, they're shocked and they're mortified that they actually did it to their animal. I think we've moved beyond the reason that we don't like those exemptions that exist in the actual bill. The first exemption is to save what they call the last resort. But with us today are multiple rescue groups from Oregon who say that they, in their contracts, will not allow declawing. They have way more cats than they know what to do with, but they will not adopt a cat on to a perfectly good home if that home is going to declaw. They have that in their contract. So they know something. These are the people who are on the ground protecting cats, and they are rescuing cats, and they have cats who are feral, meaning that they've been dumped out, who are declawed. So declawing did not save that cat's life at all. I went on the Pet Finders, which is a sort of like eBay for animals, finding an animal, and I did Salem, Oregon, and declaw to see what animals were available, and there were 181 cats registered as declawed and available looking for homes. So it's not saving lives. And one thing I wanted to make sure that you understand is that there was a study performed by a veterinarian named Landisberg, who he asked veterinarians what percentage of people who bring their cats to you, and if you were to say no, I won't declaw them, what percentage of them would relinquish the cat? And the veterinarians answered 50%. Then he went to the owners and he said, how many of you would actually have relinquished the cat or even deliberated it on it? And it was only 4%, which is a number far lower than what happens if they get declawed and they lose their homes for not using the box or biting. Those numbers are more significant. In fact, they are in the only article in the literature, they say 33%. So I just wanted to make sure that you understand that veterinarians are not the best judges on whether or not people will keep the animal. The other exemption for human health, obviously, is on the opposite side of what the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, the NIH, the U.S. Public Health Service, they're in their joint position paper on living with HIV. They say declawing a cat is not advised. They know that declawed cats bite more, and they know that a bite wound is a much more serious injury. In fact, if you ask emergency medicine doctors about what they would do if you called up and said, my cat scratched me, they say, wash it and watch it. But if they say, my cat bit me, they say, come in, because it's very often a serious injury when it's a bite, and declawed cats do bite more. It's in the literature. The last thing I wanted to say is I believe that the human-animal bond is not about modifying an animal so that it can live in your household the way you want it to. The human-animal bond is about unconditional love, and we all know that unconditional love is reciprocated between the animal and us, and it's so important. It means so much, and we shouldn't be modifying animals to fit. These are the animals we love. We shouldn't be modifying them so that they fit our lifestyles. And finally, I wanted to say thank you to Representative Barton. We met yesterday and we had a productive conversation. And thank you also to Sharon Harmon for her impassioned speech that she just gave. And thank you, Chair Gelzer and members of the committee, for allowing me to speak.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for visiting. Quickly, are there any questions? Thank you very much. So we are not going to be ready to work this today. There, we will have a few more conversations offline to see if there are more modifications to be made or not, and we will carry this over to Thursday. Thursday will be our last day. That's kind of sad. I've really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we'll still stay in touch.
Yeah, that sounds good. All right, I'm going to close the, but I did carry this over, right? I carried it over.
Yes, Thursday. Madam Chair, that's correct, and we are required by rules to post for the same type of hearing as it's had before,
okay.
But it's the Chair's discretion to to what kind of hearing to call, so long as it's posted.
Okay, so let me say that. So let me say that loudly and clearly. We're running short on time, and so we have to, under the rules, it has to be carried over under the same title that it was posted for last week. So on the agenda, it will say public hearing and possible work session, but it's a work session. It's not a public hearing. So if people are listening in the internet, flying to Oregon, we might not be able to accommodate on Thursday as the calendar is winding down here. All right. And we've sent inclusionary zoning went to rules. The indigent deceased went to ways and means. And we carried over. Okay. Thank you very, very much. I just want to say one more time that we're carrying over 3323. Okay. And we are adjourned. I get so nervous at this point. And we are adjourned. I get so nervous at this